We hope this explanation of God's word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the annual mid-year conference of UNSW, a one-week residential conference of several hundred students. These talks and question times formed the evening program after the students had undertaken a solid day of Bible study.
The first of these talks on truth is what each of the talks are going to be on, that is truth, but the first one is negative. It's also the most difficult one. And for those of you who are first-timers here at mid-year conference, that makes it even more difficult because the next little while, you're just going to find, you may find quite difficult, hang in there. For those of you who have English as a second language, buy the tapes and play them slowly later. I'll try to slow down, but as I get more excited, it will become impossible. So hang in there, try and get as much as you can from what is being said here. It's going to be difficult, but it's one that we're going to keep coming back to. It starts positive about the only truth, and it's one that really will influence everything else we're doing in the rest of the week, so we need to do it, but it is a bit more difficult. We're going to go through Romans 1, 18 to 32, but I'm going to branch off on a couple of areas, like under point 2 on God revealed, across the whole of the Bible, and then come back onto this Romans 1, 18 to 32 passage. So it's a very important part of the New Testament, this part of Romans, and it really is worthy of our careful attention. But let's start off by talking about truth positively, by asking the question, what kind of truth? So I want to try you out in a little test that I've invented here, a little true-false kind of test that Al's going to put up in the overhead. He's going to put all kinds of things up in the overhead that, for your enjoyment and for my mystification. There's a little true-false test. There are five questions in it, aren't there? One, two, three, four, five. Just on your in your pad, write down your answers. Commit yourself. Go on. Take the big gamble. Put true, false, you know, just down on you, see if you can get what is true or false on whether the world is round or flat, whether Napoleon was the greatest general, whether Jesus died by crucifixion, whether Napoleon played Sheffield Shield for New South Wales. That's a cricket game, fellows. Cricket is an intelligent game, which I won't go into it. God exists. True, false, true, false, true, true, what? It won't take that much longer, will it? You know, I mean, it's not multiple choice, it's choice of two. Here we go. Hands up those who got true, for the world is round, not flat. For those out in tape land, there is a steady show of hands. Hands up those who go for false. No idiots available. Okay, hands up those for Napoleon was the greatest general. Oh, there's a few Francophiles here. Surprising given their present practice. Hands up those who think that's false. Hands up those who didn't write anything. Yeah, we've got to have a bit of them. Okay, Jesus died by crucifixion. Hands up those who went for true. Good, thank you. Hands up those who are Muslims. Of course, the Quran says that Jesus didn't die and he didn't die by crucifixion, that God raptured Jesus up to heaven and put somebody else in his place. Often amongst these Muslim people, they believe that it was Judas Iscariot who was crucified in his place, which is a real reversal, isn't it, that the guilty man died for the innocent as opposed to the innocent dying for the guilty. But they think that's false. Right? Did anyone think it was false? Anyway, Napoleon played Sheffield Shield for New South Wales. Hands up those who went for true. Yes, okay, a couple of Queenslanders. And hands up those who thought it was false. The consensus of scholarly opinion was that he didn't play Sheffield Shield for New South Wales. And God exists. Hands up those for true. Hands up those for false. Hands up for those who didn't have an answer. Okay, now, what's the problem with this one? What is the difficulty? Which of those questions is the most difficult question? The second one, all right? Who wants to say the second one's the most difficult? Why is it the most difficult? Who can tell me why it's the most difficult? It calls for an opinion, doesn't it? Yes? You didn't know him. Well, he was an old Sheffield Shield player who... Okay, so it calls for an opinion. So, Al, why don't you help us out here? By he, we're ready already, you see, for your opinions. That is, on the first one, we want to say true. On the second one, we want to put, it's an opinion. On the third one, we want to put true. On the fourth one, we want to put false. On the fifth one, we want to put true. But, you see, there's actually another category than true, false, isn't there? There is opinion. And sometimes, well, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because the world is round, not flat. Hands up whose opinion that is. Has anyone got the opinion that the world is round, not flat? Well, everybody who put the word true in, it's your opinion, isn't it? That is, true, false means you're either in one column or the other column. But once you put another column called opinion in, well, you tick opinion every time you answer true, false, don't you? So in a sense, you should have a tick. Why don't you do it, Al? See if you can handle it, mate. I'm real difficulty. Not crosses, ticks. Can you handle ticks? You know the difference? Good. Can never be sure. He votes often and early. So really on the first one we should have a tick under true and a tick under opinion, because it's Al's opinion that the world is round, not flat. And the second one we just have a tick under opinion. The third one we have a tick under true and under opinion. And the fourth one under false and opinion. And the fifth one under true and opinion. Now, because you got opinion all the time, very opinionated man, if you don't mind me pointing this out to you, because you got opinion on every time, you see how the idea of true and false kind of gets a bit messy, doesn't it? Because at any time you say God exists, people can say to you, but that's your opinion. And you can't say it's not your opinion, because it is your opinion. Just as if you said God didn't exist, you could say, well, that's your opinion, and they couldn't say, it's not my opinion. They said, well, yes, it is my opinion. But there are some issues at which there ultimately isn't a true or false, because it can only be a matter of opinion as to who the greatest general was, because there is no definition of greatest which can command the absolute conclusion that Napoleon was it. Greatest general. In what terms? Lost the fewest number of men, made the most number of miles, had the fastest kind of victory, had the greatest number of victories. How do you judge it? There's no measure by which you can judge who is the greatest and who is not. It can only be a matter of opinion. Nothing else. Now, I want to talk over these weeks, over these nights, on truth that is independent. Point 1A, in case you wonder where we're up to. Truth that is independent. I'm talking about what is true independently of people's opinions. What is true independently of who knows it? The world was always round, even when the vast majority of people thought it was flat. The fact that the consensus of scholarly opinion and unscholarly opinion all over the world was that the world was flat didn't make it flat. It was still round. There is a truth that is independent of people's knowledge. Now, some will challenge that assumption, so that's why I'm taking a little bit of time at it right at the beginning. Some will say, no, truth, reality is only in your mind. The world is round to you, and it's flat to somebody else, and it's a prism to somebody else. I mean, you can have it in any kind of fashion you want it to be. All truth is only my truth. There is no truth independent of knowledge. Knowledge is people's perception, and people's perception is where truth is to found, and what is my truth, what is your truth, it's all just different opinions. I want to suggest to you from the beginning that that is a confusion of opinion with truth. It's a confusion of categories. Or, more commonly, it's a false view of reality. It's a false view of reality. Because the world is not as I imagine it. What I must do is imagine the world as it really is. I must conform my imagination, my thoughts to the world as it is, and not think that the world is as I imagine it. I can go through clever intellectual games on the thing, and we can confound ourselves in clever words, but in the end, positive thinking cannot overcome the reality of the world. Profound, firmly held imagination will not change the reality of the universe. I cannot overcome gravity by thinking positively on the way down. I thrust myself off the top of a tall building, and on the way down I can say to myself, gravity doesn't exist. It's all just in the mind. I am not falling. I will not hurt myself if I were falling. The world is opening up its arms to welcome. I must conform my thinking to reality and not try this absolute nonsense of thinking that reality can be conformed to my mind. There is a truth independently of my mind. And I know it, and you know it, and the clever devil who argues otherwise knows it. At least, if you want to test it, take him to the top of a tall building up there on Matthews and say, go on, you think the world is only what you think it is. Think that it will welcome you as you jump. There is a certain kind of reality we have to come to. There is a certain kind of what you would call non-arts engineering logic that is right, that needs to be taken on account of. Reminds me of a little story, which I haven't got time for, but it's too good to miss. It's one of those times. This is a story to my credit. Well, not. I was in the right place at the right moment. William Barclay wrote a book on prayer that I was studying, because I was reading every book I could on prayer, and there's 1,000 books written on prayer, and may I encourage you not to read most of them because they're rubbish. The Bible's a good book on the subject. Calvin's Institutes have a marvellous section on it. William Barclay, it's a waste of your money and your time. William Barclay was a strange man. He was Scottish, amongst other things, but can't hold that against him. But they don't play cricket there very well. However, he was writing this book on prayer. He wrote several books on prayer. And he said that God cannot suspend the laws of nature in accordance with your prayer. He said, imagine a man falls off the top of the Empire State Building. And on the way down, he prays, please, Lord, save me. He says, what prayer does is it does not save you. It does not change the world. God cannot suspend the law of gravity in order to rescue this man. What prayer does is it changes the prayer so that you are able to cope with the circumstances of life. Please, God, save me. Oh, I feel so much better. A complete absurdity. Prayer either can change things or it can't change things. God will save or God won't save. God is the sovereign Lord of his creation or he's not the sovereign Lord of his creation. But to think all that prayer does is change the prayer so that you can cope with the world, that's not what the Bible's saying. Now, I was reading this book and I just heard that day that I was reading it, a news broadcast in America, only in America, where a man fell off the top of a building by accident. And on the way down, a huge gust of wind blew him into the window on about the 40th floor, much to the consternation of the typist who was just inside. God may not be able to suspend his law of gravity, he may or may not, but God has more at his disposal than just the suspension of the law of gravity. He has a whole range of other availables to him. And whereas Mr. Barclay could not imagine how God could save somebody in such a situation, God can save anybody in any situation and change the circumstances and situation of life in accordance with his will and purposes. Never underestimate the power of God. Now I'm talking about the world as it really is, but I am including God in the world as it really is. And I'm not talking about my God or your God. I'm not talking about God as I like to think of him, the make-up God in the imagination of your own mind. I'm talking about the God as he is, whether or not we believe in him, whether or not we know him, whether or not we understand him. That is, just as I want to conform my knowledge to the reality of the world rather than conforming the reality of the world to my knowledge, so I want to conform my knowledge to the reality of God rather than conforming God to the reality of my knowledge. Very, very silly words when people start off sentences like, I like to think of God as. It tells you nothing about God, but it tells you everything about what they like to think. Basically, you know that what they like to think is stupid because they think they can think up God in the form that they want. So the sentence, it's the introduction to heresy. Whenever people like to start off, I would like to think of God as, you know you're about to hear arrant nonsense and heresy. Because it's the God who is we've got to think about, not the God who we want to think about. That's the one we're dealing with, so we've got to take the givens of this world. Now, reading Romans 1, chapter 1, verses 19 to 20, we can see that God is knowable. Verse 19. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. God is knowable. Invisible, yes, but knowable. What is known is his power and his deity, and his power and his deity can be seen in his creation, so that anyone who wants to reject the knowledge of God, they are without excuse, because God has chosen to make plain himself. And he's chosen to make it plain to all people. Now, more of this in a moment, this choosing to make things plain. But Romans is speaking not just of a God who is there, but it's also speaking of a God who is knowable. For it's theoretically possible that God is there and unknowable to our minds, to us. We don't know who he is or what he is or whether he's there or not. But no, the Bible says God is there and he is knowable. We can know him. In fact, it is plain for all of us. Now, this God whom we can know is intolerable. Is intolerable. So this is where we're moving from truth into the subject of tolerance, because he is intolerable. Because what is seen in creation, verse 20, is his eternal power and divine nature. What is seen in creation is such that in verse 21, we should give thanks to him, we should glorify him, and in verse 25, you'll notice, we should worship him as our creator. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the created things rather than the creator, who is forever to be praised. We should praise him, glorify him, give thanks to him, and acknowledge him as the creator. And that is why God is intolerable. Because he made everything, including me. And as the maker of everything, including me and you, he rules over everything, including you and me. He owns everything, including you and me. I am not the boss of me. He is the boss of me. I do not exist because I want to exist. I exist because he brought me into existence. I owe my everything to him. And furthermore, because he created everything, there is no rival to him. There is no alternative to him except a false alternative to him. There is no other God. There is only one true God of all creation. And therefore he is intolerable to us. Intolerable to us because of our wickedness, because we do not want God to be God in our lives. We want to be God in our lives, and therefore we suppress the truth. Verse 18, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all godless and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Because we are wicked, we do not want a God to whom we're answerable, a God who rules over us, a God who owns us and who's going to hold us to account, a God before whom we would make excuse, but before whom we can make no excuse. If we weren't wicked, then God would not be intolerable, but as intolerable people, we find the truth of God. As wicked people, we find the truth of God intolerable. And so what you do when you find a truth intolerable? You suppress the truth. You censor it. You hold it down. You shoot the messenger because you don't like the message. You won't allow it proclaimed. You won't allow it to be thought. You won't allow it to affect your life. You will avoid it. Now, that's where we're going to go in a few moments. But before we do, let's get back to this business about knowing God. And how do we know God? The answer of how do we know God is that God reveals himself. Being God, the only way in which we can know God is by revelation. God does more than reveal himself. He also saves the world. He made the world. He judges the world. He does all kinds of things as well. But he does reveal himself so that we may know him. Revelation is the idea of disclosure, of showing, of telling. That's what revelation is. It's not discovery, and it's not rational reflection. I want you to think about what is in my right-hand pocket. Now, just by thinking about it, you cannot work out what is in my right hand. You could get a guess, couldn't you? But you can't actually think it. You can't work it out from there. And unless you hold me down and plunge your hands into my pocket, you can't actually discover what is in my right-hand pocket. But I can reveal it to you. I can take it out and show you what is in my right-hand pocket. The knowledge that you have of God is a revelation, is a being shown, is being made clear, is being disclosed to you. That's how you know God. So verse 19, those very important little words here, since what may be known about God is plain to them, why? Because God has made it plain to them. It's not plain to them because it is plain to them. It is not plain to them because they're very clever and can work it out. It's plain to them because God made it plain to them. Because God chose to reveal himself. Because revelation involves sovereignty. I can choose to hide what is inside my pocket. I can choose to reveal to you what is inside my pocket. It is my pocket and my choice as whether I will show it to you or whether I'll hide it from you. God is God. He can choose to let people know who he is, or he can hide himself. It's his choice. He chose to make it plain to us, to reveal himself to us in creation. That is, we know because God wants us to know, because he is God. Because he is the sovereign ruler of the universe, he is the one who determines whether or not he wants to be known. Look, you know that with yourself, don't you? You ever been in the room where you're in a context with people and you're feeling antisocial, you're feeling sick? I'll be charitable. You've got a splitting headache and you really don't want to talk to anybody. And there are all these people around about, and so what you do is you just don't look them in the eye. You know, you go over in the corner and you read a coffee table book, you know, and you just bury yourself in the book and let the party go on around about you. Because, and if someone does come over and say anything to you, say, oh, no, I'm all right, I'll just have a cup of coffee, it's okay. And you don't tell them who you are, what the problem is. You choose not to let the other person know who you are. That's your choice, isn't it? It's an antisocial choice, but it's a choice that you can make. Or you can let yourself be known. You can talk to people and reveal things about yourself and describe what you're interested in, and you can make friends by revealing things to yourself. It's like that this week, isn't it? You can make friends this week or you can make no friends this week. Who determines whether you make friends or not? You do. By your willingness to reveal yourself to other people. You tell nobody anything about yourself and you'll leave this place without friends. You may know other people, but they won't know you. But as you talk to people, as you show them that you're interested in softball or you play cricket or you're fascinated in politics, or as you talk about your brothers and your sisters or that you come from Tasmania and you're not dead and you have... As you reveal things about yourself, so people will get to know you. So friendship is made. God chooses whether he will be known or not, and he has chosen to make himself known to everyone. And so it's not that we work it out, it's not that we've thought it up. Now that's important for several reasons. It's important because it means that we can't rule over God, God rules over us. It's not for me to say, well, I think I'll work out whether God exists or not, and I am not the sovereign over the knowledge of God. God is sovereign over the knowledge of himself. It's important because if you could only come to God by working it out because it's very difficult to work out, then only the clever people would be saved. And the stupid people would not be saved. Which would be difficult for lots of us, wouldn't it? And further, it's because you can't know God, even from creation, by logic or philosophy. Even in creation, you only know him because he chooses to be known. So the logical proofs for the existence of God will never come to a knowledge of God, even if they were logical and even if they did prove it. You can only come to know God because God has made it plain to you. So verse 19, he's made it plain to all. But how and where does God reveal? Well, there's three places. Creation, the Old Testament, and the New Testament. We'll do those three places and then we'll sing a song before we go over to the second page, which is a lot quicker and easier than the first page. This is the hard bit. You ready? You want to just wriggle your toes for a moment or two and take a couple of deep breaths and that kind of thing. I won't get you to stand up because I know what will happen. Ready? Here we go. Creation, first of all. Notice 6 points about revelation in creation, and the first one takes a long time. How am I going to fit 6 points in that little squibby bit of paper? All right? Well, there's a bank page next to it, isn't it? Just go back over that. Firstly, in Revelation, it's to everybody. It's to everybody. To all. So that men are without excuse. It's been revealed against all godlessness and wickedness. It may be plain for all to see. Now, why is this going to take a little bit longer? Because this actually helps us with an old conundrum. You see, we are caught, we Christians, on the horns of a dilemma. And the horns that Al has for us, straight out of Texas, those ones, aren't they? The horns of the dilemma run like this. It's the old question, what about those who have never heard the gospel? Heard that question thrown to you? Now, why do non-Christians like that question? Well, because it catches you on one point or the other. You see, if you were to say, well, those who have never heard the gospel, that's just tough for them. They're lost. They're condemned. Then the non-Christian could say, well, it's not fair. They were never given a chance. How can God condemn people to hell who never had a chance to hear any message to save them? If, on the other hand, you say, oh, well, all the people who have never heard the gospel, they're going to be saved automatically, right? Because it wouldn't be fair to condemn them. So they're automatically saved. Then the non-Christian says, well, don't tell me anything about the gospel. I don't want to hear another word. Because as long as you don't tell me, I'm saved. But as soon as you start telling me, I've got a chance of being lost. So shut up, get lost. Either way, the non-Christian wins, doesn't he? Either God's not fair, or you should shut up, one or the other. Either way, the non-Christian wins. So they love. What about those who have never heard the gospel? What is the answer? Well, it's a very simple answer. The people who have never heard the gospel have never existed. They don't exist. For the very heavens declare the glory of God, and that's what the gospel is. What may be known about God is plain to all people because God has chosen to make it plain to all people. They don't exist. For the creation itself gives you enough knowledge of God by which you could come into right relationship with him, but you choose not to. The key to it is that ignorance, which is usually spelled differently to that, ignorance is not... No, it's a wonderful way of spelling it. Good. Ignorance is no excuse before the law. You see, I'm driving down Anzac Parade outside the University in New South Wales there, and 120 k's. And the policeman pulls me over and he says, you're speeding, sir. And I say, am I? And he says, yeah, I've just clocked you at 120 k's. I said, that's interesting. My dial said 120 k's too. And he says, yes, well, that's speeding. And I said, well, it is certainly going fast. He says, no, it's breaking the law. And I said, is that a fact? Well, I didn't know that. Tough. That's no excuse, is it? Why is it no excuse? Because the law is public, and it's the citizen's responsibility to know what the law says. The law is publicly enacted in Parliament, and you can go into the gallery and listen to them, and then it is gazetted in the Government Gazette, declared and proclaimed for everybody to know, and it is the responsibility of everybody to know. Now, if the law of the land was made in secret, if it was never published, then you could say, well, it's not my fault, I didn't know what the law was, and it might actually work. But because the law is public, ignorance of the law is no excuse. Is the knowledge of God private or public? Romans chapter 1, it is as public as it can be. The whole creation declares the presence, the divine power, the divine nature of God, so that people are without excuse. Oh, they don't know the name Jesus, but they know of God, and they should give thanks to him, and they should glorify him, verse 21, and they should serve the Creator, verse 25, and they should glorify the Creator. They know enough of God to respond to God. It is their choice. Ignorance is no excuse. Point two under creation. They're all easy, and they're much shorter, the other ones. Point two is what you see in creation. Point two is his eternal power. A God who can create the universe is powerful. And what you also see in creation is his divine nature. That is, he is the creator. He is beyond creation. He's not part of creation. He's over and above creation. He has brought the thing into being. He is powerful and divine. Point four, what you can see is that people are without excuse for denying the truth. Write down, I'll read it to you, Acts chapter 17, where Paul is on the Areopagus in Athens. And he argues in verse 28, 29, when he's talking to them about the unknown God that they are worshipping. For in him, he says, we live and move and have our being, as some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we shouldn't think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made in man's design and skill. See, even the pagan poet knew that humans were in a special relationship with God. Even the pagan poet knew that we are God's offspring. And yet, they worship God with gold and silver and statues, which are less than human. Now, what can be known about God is such that we are without excuse when we turn to other gods. Fifthly, verse 25, we should give glory and thanks to God for his divine nature and power. We are responsible to do that. And sixthly, there is enough known of God that we have a conscience. Verse 32. Although they know God's righteous decrees that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these very things, but also approve those who practice them. Here is a strange phenomenon about us. Although they have given themselves over to all kinds, verse 29, of wickedness, evil, greed, depravity, yet they still know there is a right and there is a wrong. They still know that those who do such things are wrong. Verse 32, there is still a conscience. The Samoans, West Samoans, big footballers, the Samoans, in their pre-Christian days, were opposed to adultery. They saw it as immoral and wrong. So that when they became Christians, that was not part of what had to be changed in their culture. It was wrong before they became Christians, it was wrong after they became Christians. Even without knowing the knowledge of God in the scriptures, they knew it was wrong. The same with Joseph. Remember Joseph, coat of many colours and all that? Joseph, some of you just know it through a song and through a stage show that you did in high school. That right? That Joseph? Remember he was sold into slavery down in Egypt? His master, Potiphar, and his master's wife, Potiphar's wife, she tried to seduce Joseph, and Joseph wouldn't allow it and ran away from the house naked rather than be seduced in adultery, because he would not sin against God by committing adultery. What's extraordinary about that? Well, Joseph happens 400 years before Moses is given the commandment, you shall not commit adultery. You start in Genesis 1 and read all the way through to Joseph, you'll never be taught that it's wrong to commit adultery. But Joseph knew it was wrong. The knowledge of right and wrong is not just found in the Word of God, it's found in the knowledge that God is there and should be respected and responded to appropriately. There is found in the conscience of the human heart, even in the conscience of the sinful human heart. They know these things are wrong and yet approve those who practice them. It's the character of, isn't it? Now, from creation, you don't know much, but you do know this much. That's what's being said, but you don't know very much. But that's the teaching of Scripture, that you do know God. So in Acts 17 and verse 23, you find that they are worshipping an unknown God. But this unknown God that they're worshipping, Paul then explains to them, as to the fact that he is the creator, explains to them that they know even more than they think they know, explains to them that the way they treat him with idols is stupid, explains to them in these terms. He says, in the past, verse 30, God overlooked such ignorance. Now the word ignorance is a key little word here, because there's two kinds of ignorance, isn't there? There is the ignorance whereby I don't know because I've never been told. Right? So it just is, just Nick, don't tell me. Hands up those who know Nick's middle name. I'm so glad you do, Kirsty. That's wonderful. How long have you been married now? Yes, okay, so his wife. Anyone else knows Nick's middle name? His mother's not here. Good. Okay. Now, that's because we're ignorant, isn't it? Right? That's why we don't know his middle name. We're just ignorant of it. No one is morally culpable for not knowing his middle name. Right? There's no law of the land which says everybody must know Nick's middle name, is there? It's just we don't know. Never had a chance to find out. Now, Nick, if you don't tell any of us, and Kirsty, you don't tell any of us, we never will know, really, will we? We're just stuck here in ignorance. I mean, we'll be up all night worrying about this. I wonder what Nick's middle name is. What would go with Nick? You know, Nigel? No, he's got a wife, so he's not completely Nigel. What do you reckon of him? Methuselah, yeah? Yeah, it's Nick Methuselah, yeah? I mean, we just don't know what this is. It requires revelation. But once he tells us what his middle name is, then for us not to know will require us to ignore the information. So if Nick was to kind of whisper it to me and I was to broadcast, I'm just going to announce to you Nick's middle name, and you said, don't do it. You're no longer ignorant. You have ignored, haven't you? Now, of course, the two go hand in hand, because if you ignore information, then you remain ignorant of it, don't you? But there's a moral difference, isn't there? Someone who's just ignorant because they never had a chance to find out, well, that's not morally blamable. But somebody who's ignorant because they chose to ignore the information, now that's different, isn't it? That's why ignorance of the law is no excuse, because you've ignored the law. Now, God is plain, but people ignore. That's the ignorance. Now, in the past, he says in Acts chapter 17, verse 30, God overlooked such ignorance, but now it's that kind of ignorance that God has overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent because he's fixed a day of judgment and so on. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 21, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 21, we're told that the knowledge of God is not open to the wisdom of men. It's not open to the debaters of this age, because God chooses to make himself known his own way, not the way we want him, because he's not going to be at our disposal to think up the way we want to think him up. It's not open to debate. We know enough of God to know that God is there, but we don't know enough to satisfy all our questions. Indeed, the book of Ecclesiastes, which we worked through in first session in campus Bible study, that's what about, isn't it? Remember Ecclesiastes chapter 3? If I can find it quickly, I'll refer back to it. You know the bit that's the song? a time for this and a time for that and a time for everything else that's happening under heaven. Ecclesiastes 3, remember how it finishes. A time to hate, a time to love, a time for war, a time for peace. What does the worker gain from his toil? I've seen the burden God has laid on men. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He's also set eternity in their hearts of men. Yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. We have in the sense of time a sense that things have meaning and rhyme and purpose, but we don't know what the meaning, the rhyme and the purpose is. We know that there's more to this world than just this world, but we don't know what it is that there is. We know that there is an eternity, but we don't know what the eternity is about. We know that there's God, but we don't know who God is. A fascinating book came out some years ago called Eternity in Their Hearts, using that phrase, by Don Richardson. Don Richardson was an interesting man. He came and spoke on our campus in the 1970s, just when he'd finished his years as a missionary in Irianjaya. He spent 10 years in Irianjaya, West New Guinea, living amongst the Dani people who were cannibals. They didn't eat him because they didn't know that white men died. They assumed they lived forever because he was the only white man they'd met and he hadn't died. And so he didn't find out for about 5 years, that piece of information. And when he did find out, he didn't kind of tell them. With good reason. They were fascinating people, the Dani people, and it's a really interesting case. He wrote a book called Peace Child, which told how the people in the Dani people were converted and the whole tribe came over to the Lord Jesus Christ in a wonderful story. But when he returned to America, he started working on the idea of primitive peoples and their knowledge of God. And what he saw around the world from the missionaries who have worked amongst primitives, and he is the great expert in primitives, you can't get much more primitive than the people he was working amongst. What he found was that everywhere they all believed in God. And they all believed in the one high supreme being, God. They may have worshipped other gods as well, but they all, in their substructure of their thought and understanding, had a view of monotheism, which was completely contrary to the kind of anthropological teachings of atheism coming out of the University of Liverpool, which saw agnosticism and atheism as the result of theism and theism as the result of, monotheism, and that's the result of theism, and that everybody starts off polytheists. Everybody starts off worshipping trees and the sun and the moon and the house and the cat and the... And then gradually over time they get fewer and fewer gods until they come to this great idea of one God, and that then gives them the idea of ethics. And when they understand ethics, they realise they don't need God at all, they just move to agnosticism, and then you reach the great pinnacle of human development called atheism and get to have a chair in anthropology at the University of Liverpool. Now, why Liverpool would be the epitome of human civilisation, I cannot understand, although it's soccer, they're not bad. But Richardson says, but when you go back and look at the primitive peoples of the world, they all actually believe in one supreme being. But all around the world, everywhere you go, in the background of all these polytheistic thoughts was the knowledge that there actually is, ultimately, one great God. It's a very interesting read, The Eternity in Their Hearts. I think it's still around, but I'm not sure it's on our bookstore this week. I don't think it is. In creation, people know that there is God. How else do we know? Well, through the Old Testament. The next 2 points are easier and I'll take less time because they're not as relevant to Romans 1, but let's flesh it out. God is also revealed in the Old Testament, not universally, but to the people of Israel. To find it most easily, turn to Hebrews chapter 1, because that way we can get both the New Testament and Old Testament in the same verses. Hebrews 1, verses 1, 2, 3. Why don't you look it up? It's a complex sentence. A little bit of finger exercise will help in keeping us awake at this point. The rustle of paper reminds me of the offertory time at church. It's wonderful. That's a joke, friends. Just better say that. You know, every now and then there are people who really take these things seriously. We don't take offertories in our church anyway. You ready? Hebrews 1. In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom he made the universe. In the past, God spoke piecemeal, bit by bit, to our forefathers, the Israelites, by prophets. One prophet would tell a bit, another prophet would tell a bit more, another prophet would tell a bit more. Over centuries, more and more information about God came as God spoke bit by bit. He spoke to the family of Abraham in Genesis 12, 1-3, and told them the great plan of salvation that he had for the world, and the plan for Abraham's family, and the key part that Abraham's family part would play for the rest of the world. He reinforced that in the Exodus when he spoke to Moses, and he revealed to Moses his covenant, his contract with the people, which had its laws like the 10 words, the 10 commandments. He also revealed Moses his name. He told him who he was, what his name meant. In Exodus chapter 34, verses 6 and 7, he says, "My name is Yahweh." And the name Yahweh means, and then he spells out that the character of God, the character of his own person. And so they knew even more. And they found out more about him, say, in Isaiah 45. In Isaiah 45, he made it clear through the prophet Isaiah that there is one God over all the world. And although the Babylonians had conquered them, God was the God of Babylonia. And although Cyrus the Persian was going to now come and conquer the Babylonians and rescue the people of Israel, you shouldn't complain about it, because God's the God of Cyrus as well. Because there's not different gods of different nations. There's one God and only one God. And there is no other God. Isaiah chapter 45 is a great passage of it, which is an important thing because people don't understand that these days. We're moving back into dualism. Let me come with me for a moment to Isaiah 45. I just want to, it's a little off the track, but seeing I've got a chance of hitting a nail right on the head, why don't I hit it so that I don't have to stub my toe on it later on. You won't stub your toe on it, and because it'll upset some of you, and that'll do you good. Isaiah 45. Pick up verse 5. "I am the Lord and there is no other. Apart from me there is no God. I will strengthen you though you have not acknowledged me, so that from the rising of the sun to the place of its setting men may know there is none beside me. I am the Lord and there is no other. I form the light and create darkness. I bring prosperity and create disaster. I, the Lord, do all these things." There's only one God in all the world, who is the sovereign Lord of all things, and there is no other. It makes it very clear, doesn't it? But that means the rain and the sun come from the one God. The stable land of Australia and the earthquake-ridden land of New Zealand come from the one same God. Both the earthquakes and the stability come from God. The health that you enjoy and the sickness that I don't, both comes from God. It's exactly the same. Because today there are people running around saying, well, there's the good God and there's the bad God, and they're at war with each other. And we're not always sure who's going to win, the good God and the bad God. And we are living in between these two things that are operating, the good God and the bad God. And so every time you get sick, well, that's the bad God. And every time you get better, that's the good God. That's not how the Bible sees it. God creates disasters as well as he creates prosperity. He creates wealth and he creates poverty. He creates the sun and the rain. He creates the floods and the earthquakes. And he creates the good harvest and the bad harvest. God is the sovereign Lord of all things. Well, I'd just like to point out about the New Testament, about God. Let's turn to the New Testament and back to Hebrews 1. And you'll see in Hebrews 1 that in the past God spoke by the prophets. But in the last times, in recent times, now in these last days, because we've come to the end of the history time, in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son. So whereas the Old Testament he spoke by prophets, now he's spoken by the Son. And whereas the prophets knew little snippets of what was happening, the Son gives you the full revelation of God himself. Because look at who this Son is. He is the heir of all things, through whom he made the universe. He is, verse 3, the radiance of God's glory, the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. Philip, if you have seen me, you have seen the Father. John chapter 14, I think it's about verse, Al will put it up, 9, I think. That in the Old Testament, You had snippets of information, but in the New Testament you have the fulfillment of the Old Testament. In Matthew 5, verse 17 following, 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 20, Matthew 5, 17, 2 Corinthians 1, 20, Jesus is the yes and amen. He is the fulfillment of all that took place in the Old Testament. And whereas 2 Corinthians 1, 20 and Matthew 5, 17 following, and whereas in the Old Testament you got bits and pieces, and the people who were writing it didn't even understand it. So 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 10 to 12, we're told the prophets, 1 Peter 1, 10 to 12, the prophets didn't even know what they were talking about, and some have short memories. 1 Peter 1, 10 to 12. The prophets didn't understand what it was that they were writing about, but we know because we have been this side of the Lord Jesus Christ and his death and resurrection. And so come with me to Luke chapter 24, Luke chapter 24, and which is the end, you know, of Luke's gospel. Jesus has risen from the dead. He's in the upper room with his disciples. Luke 24, and he said to them in verse 44, "This is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets and the Psalms." Are you up to it now? Verse 45, Luke 24, verse 45. "Then he opened their minds so that they could understand the scriptures, and he told them, 'This is what is written. The Christ will suffer and rise from on the third day, and the repentance and forgiveness of sins will be preached in his name to all nations beginning at Jerusalem.'" You see, they didn't understand what the prophets said. The prophets didn't understand what they were talking about, and the Jews didn't understand what the prophets had been talking about until the Son came, who made it all clear. For he was the fulfillment of all that had been prophesied. He was the missing key to an understanding of the jigsaw puzzle called the Old Testament. But once he came, then all was made clear. The revelation of God was complete for us, so that we could now know God through his Son. Right, we're past the hardest bit, and we need a break. And I think the best way of getting the break so that a few who are desperate can... Okay, this is how we know God. Know the knowable God, because he chose to reveal himself, creation, Old Testament, New Testament, but everybody in creation is what Romans 1 is about, and that's where we're going back to, Romans 1, 18 following. Because Romans 1 is actually not about knowing God. I've spent more than half the talk on it, but that's not what it's about. That's the assumption that you've got to spell out and work out the implications of. What Romans 1 is not knowing the truth. What Romans 1 is about is suppressing the truth. That's what this passage is about, suppressing the truth. It's the key phrase of it in verse 18. I've got to look it up before I can read it to you, haven't I? Romans 1, 18. "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all our godless and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness." That's what the passage is about. The truth of God is intolerable to rebellious people. And the nature of wickedness is not so much to deny the truth as to suppress it. That is to hold it down. It's like trying to hold down a huge balloon underneath the water. We actually haven't got the strength to hold it down under the water. It keeps on popping up, bits and pieces of it. And every bit that pops up, we put our hand over and push it down. Another bit pops up and we push it down there. The truth is there. We actually, in the end, can't deny the balloon is under the water. But what we're trying to do all the time is hold it down beneath the surface of the water. And so the truth is there, but the truth will out. But we are suppressing the truth. We are avoiding the truth. We are pretending about the truth. We are censoring the truth, but it's self-censoring. The devil came to the woman in Genesis chapter 3, verse 1 to 7. And said, "Did God really say, 'You will not die'?" The essence of the devil's work is to tell lies. We're going to look at more of the devil tomorrow night on John chapter 8, but the essence of the devil's work is to tell lies. And the power that the devil has is the power we give him. The devil has no power of himself. He only has the power that we give him. And the way we give him power is by believing his lies. You and I underestimate the power of lies. But by lies, the devil has ruled the world. And in our wickedness, we prefer lies to truth. And as you prefer lies, so you continue to give the power to the evil one. But it is the truth that will set you free. And what we do is suppress the truth. And that's why it says that we suppress it by wickedness. That is, we know the truth, but we ignore the truth because we're wicked. The problem is not the truth. The problem is not its revelation. The problem is our reception. There's none so blind as those who will not see. It's that marvellous poem of John Donne that I love so much about busy old fool, unruly son. You know, the sun comes to wake him up in the morning, but he's in his lover's arms and in her bed and he does not want to be woken up. And so he says, go chide schoolboys, tell them they're late for school, go and chase after the apprentices and get them off to work, but leave me alone here with my beloved. He says, you think you're so powerful you can wake up the world? You're not so powerful. All I have to do is shut my eyes and you don't exist. Well, that's what the world does, you see, suppress the truth. The sun's not there because I got my eyes shut. The sun is there whether you've got the eyes shut or open. In fact, if you leave your eyes shut long enough, you'll get sunburnt eyelids. For there's a great foolishness in suppressing the truth, because there is the truth there, and the truth will affect you one way or another. There's the problem. We ignore the truth because we're wicked. And so look at verse 25. What have they done? The truth of God is exchanged for a lie. The motive, of course, is our sinfulness. We don't want God to be God over our lives. We want to do our own thing. Because we want to do our own thing, we can't have God. Well, I've got a choice now. I'm either going to do God's thing or I'm going to do my thing. Well, I'm not sure God's there. I know God is there. But I don't want God to be telling me what to do. So it's easy to say, well, very clever people don't believe in God, you know. And so it goes. Margaret Mead. Hands up those who have never heard of Margaret Mead. Ah, that's blessing. Wonderful. I'm so relieved. Let me tell you about her. Well, I mean, if you haven't heard, I can speak freely. No, that's not the reason. No, Margaret Mead is someone who has dominated Western thinking for most of this century, and that her popularity has run out on the undergraduate generation that you're in is a great sign of intellectual health for the future. Margaret Mead was an American. It's not her fault, she was born there. anthropologist. Who in the early part of this century, in the 20s, etc., did her anthropological studies and published them abroad, and was one of the leaders of our cultural shift in this century. She argued that sexual repression that comes from morality of our Western Puritan character is actually harmful for us, and is destructive and leads people to suicides and leads to malfunctions within our sexuality and bad events in terms of raising our children and destroying our families, etc. And she went to prove this by studying the Samoan culture, where she argued that there was no adultery and there was no sexual repression and there were no suicides, that people lived communally, that the families raised all the children. It wasn't just I raise my children, you raise your children. They all lived together and everybody was responsible for everybody's children. No one kept themselves within a tight monogamous relationship. You would have sex with whomever you wanted to have sex with, whenever you wanted to have sex with anybody. And there was never any kind of rape. There was never any disharmony between people or fighting over common partners or any difficulty with people moving in and out of as many marriages as they wanted to move in and out of. They had total freedom of sexuality, and as a result of their total freedom of sexuality, they had total harmony within their community. They had none of the bad effects of Western civilization. It was a marvellous message, and she became, through her writings, one of the foremost world anthropologists and one of the cultural intellectual leaders of our society and our world. preaching cultural relativism was the great theme. You see, you think that there are absolutes, like you shall not commit adultery, but that's because the only culture you know is the Western Christianized culture. Step outside that, go to Samoa, and you'll find there's different ways of conducting yourself, completely free, and you think this is the best way to live. You go out to West Samoa and you'll find out there's a much better way to live, a much happier way. And we've got to free ourselves from the shackles of our repressive Protestantism and enjoy our sexual freedoms. In the 1980s, a man called Derek Freeman, who was an Australian, and that's not his fault, he was born here. Why is it not so funny when I mention that one, eh? Derek Freeman debunked Margaret Mead's work fairly comprehensively. He did considerable studies in Samoa, was there for many years as an anthropology, and he showed that what she wrote was actually not true. It was not true of pagan Samoa, and it was not true of Christian Samoa, and Samoa is a very Christian nation. That even under paganism, adultery was adultery and was considered to be very bad. And even under paganism, why, they did have hatreds and warfares, and they had very strong sexual morality, and when they became Christians, they continued with strong sexual morality. That it wasn't the free and easy kind of open marriage, free love that she portrayed it at any case. And he looked into what she had done in her anthropological research, and really, the scholarship was so poor as to be something of a scandal. She only spent 6 months there, whereas he had spent a couple of decades. She hadn't learnt the language. In 6 months you don't learn the language of another, let alone understand the cultural nuances of another place. It was ridiculous, but that's all she'd done. She hadn't even lived with them. She'd lived with other Americans close by and just went in for day visits. She really hadn't done the work at all. And what she had written up was completely wrong. And since the early 1980s and Derek Freeman's work and the intellectual debate that has pursued from it, Margaret Mead is now one of the intellectual scandals and frauds of this century. She died in 1978. Why did Margaret Mead believe what she believed? And why did the intellectual community swallow it wholesale? When I grew up and went to university, you could not say a word against Margaret Mead. She was the last word on cultural relativism, on sexual ethics, on the New Age and the New World. It was unthinkable that she was a fraud. Today, she is an embarrassment to the intellectual community. Why? Why did they believe it? Why did she write it? Well, I picked up an interesting book the other day, a Roman Catholic book, an anti-Protestant book, actually, by E. Michael Jones, called Degenerate Moderns, with a vulgar Picasso painting on the front. I actually was in a motel room the other day reading it, and this woman came in and to clean the room and saw that I was reading a book on degenerate moderns, modernity as rationalised sexual misbehaviour. Gave me a very strange look. What is that? No, it's a Christian book. It's actually a little bit, it was lost. You know, it was just gone. Anyway, he writes an interesting chapter on Margaret Mead and reveals much of her personal life, but you can find it in other places as well. You see, Margaret Mead married just as she was undertaking her postgraduate study, but she went off to New York where she met up with a man and had an adulterous relationship. On the way to West Samoa, on the way to Samoa, feeling particularly guilty about this adulterous relationship, she called in to see her old mentor in the Rockies, where she spent a couple of weeks confessing the sinfulness of this adulterous relationship and agreeing with her mentor, 15 years as a senior, her teacher, that she would give up that relationship completely, but in the process entering into a relationship with her mentor, a sexual relationship with her teacher, who was a woman, so that she now moved from marriage to adultery to lesbianism. She went out to Samoa and then found out about the Samoans and their sexual freedoms and liberties, and she wrote up the whole theory on the boat on the way back to France. But on the boat she met up with another anthropologist, a man with whom she started yet another sexual relationship. So she went back to Paris, where she met up with her husband, and the three of them lived in a sexual kind of trio in Paris for some time before she divorced her husband to marry the second man. She then went out subsequently to New Guinea, where out there she met up with another anthropologist. She was with her husband anthropologist this time, but she then moved in with the third man, and the three of them lived down by the Sepik River for a while until her mentor, the lesbian, came over and joined them, and she had her two men and her woman all living with her down by the Sepik River, where she did more of her anthropological research. Where do you think her conclusions about the truth of Samoan culture came from? Not hard to work it out, is it? You don't have to be Houdini. The private life of academics is relevant to their research. That is one of the forbidden statements of the intellectual community today. That is about as politically incorrect as we are going to get this week. Think about it for a moment. I am saying that the private lives of academics is important and relevant in the evaluation of their research and publishing and ideas that they are promoting. And Margaret Mead is a classic illustration of it. For her research was nothing other than the rationalisation of her own wickedness, foisted upon a world which was happy to believe it, for it taught the same wickedness that they were practising. Because of their sexual immorality, they were relieved to hear what she had discovered. It rationalised their behaviour so that she became the champion of the sexual revolution, which was a cause taken up by the sexually immoral in the universities of this world. The idea that you can detach people's private life from their intellectual life is something that Freud clearly had demonstrated was ridiculous. But then again, we've now found about Freud's private life. And when you find about Freud's private life, you'll understand why Freud was a Freudian. Or should I say, Freud was a Freudian. For that basically is the case. There's a long chapter about him. It's the same with all of them. That their private lives of immorality gave rise to what it was about. You see, Freud was the one so caught up with the whole incest taboo. But we found out right from the days in which he was writing that his arguments about the taboo on incest all around the world was not true. He quoted Australian Aborigines. That was a safe thing to do in Austria. No one's going to come out and check up whether he was saying was true or not, but it was checked up. It was found to be untrue, but nobody paid attention to that. His incest taboo was also part of his own psychiatric problems. For he had a thing for his sister-in-law who was living in the bedroom next to his bedroom, that she had to walk through his bedroom to get to her bedroom every night, and he had a real problem about that. Because he was caught up with Nietzsche and the whole idea that to be a superman you must be freed from morality, and the way to be freed from morality is to do the most evil thing you can think of, and the most evil thing he could think of was incest, and because of his own incestuous behaviour he created a theory that landed on everybody all over the world. He rationalised his own degeneracy by bringing everybody else into the same level of lies that he was practicing. Or Karl Marx is the same kind of thing. You can find out about Karl Marx in that book, Paul Johnson, The Intellectuals. You check it out there, it's the same thing. Karl Marx lived off capitalists all his life. He didn't actually know very many workers. The only worker he really knew was the slave that he kept downstairs in his own house, through whom he had a child that he refused to acknowledge. There was the great champion of the proletariat. There was the man who was going to liberate the peoples of the world. He had his own slave. Never paid her, gave her a child, and refused to acknowledge the child or her. It goes on and on. When you look at the private lives of the intellectuals, as Paul Johnson has done, you will see why it is they have come to the views they have come to. And it has almost nothing to do with rationality. It has to do with wickedness and degeneracy. But to say it is to breach the great taboo of our intellectual community. The privacy of other people's lives. It's playing the man, not the ball, isn't it? I'm sorry if you don't understand the illustration of playing a man, not the ball. I can't help you because you don't understand football. People who don't understand that, I can't help. But that's what it is, isn't it? You're not allowed to do that. You've got to play the idea, not the person. When the reason for the idea is the person and their own immorality. And so notice what happens in verse 23. They exchange a truth for a lie. That is, they exchange God for idols. But as soon as you change the truth for the lie, you will change to stupidity and foolishness. So it's not just truth for lie, but, well, look at it here, verse 21. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile. Their foolish hearts were darkened, and although they claimed to be wise, they became fools. That's the problem. Once you move from truth to lie, you move to foolishness as well. And so they worship stars. They worship astrology. You worship the kinds of things that don't make sense at all, that are stupid. Astrology is profoundly stupid. It's even got the stars in the wrong sector of the whole system. They've even got the wrong number. There's actually 13 periods, not 12, but they've got it all wrong. But people, 1/12 of the people here tonight are going to have exactly the same fortune as tomorrow because you were born on the same day, under the same star sign. Because you're all of the same age, it was the same year. So this is a very weird group of people to deal with, because 1/12 of us are going to meet the same kind of romantic experience tomorrow, maybe with each other. 80% of Australians read the star columns regularly. 28% believe that there's truth in it. 28% take it seriously. What foolishness. What absurdity that people go on with. And though they think they're actually going to be helped by having a crystal or by channeling or by new birthing, all the new age paraphernalia, which is complete gobbledygook. It's nonsense. It is the foolishness. So the wisdom they change to foolishness. Sherlock Holmes, great atheist. Well, his author was Conan Doyle, great atheist. Great anti-Christian. He believes in fairies. He did. Read up the stories of Conan Doyle. It's quite fascinating. He came into scientific paranormal psychology and all that kind of thing, and he found some fairies. He found a photograph of a group of fairies down in a garden, and he went around the world telling people about the fairy discovery until the people who dressed up to make the photograph exposed it as a complete fraud. But he did. That's what he did. Kubler-Ross. You've heard of Kubler-Ross, the woman who's taught us how to die with grace and pleasure. Well, Kubler-Ross, you know, has got to be off the planet. I mean, she's a psychiatrist, a great academic, who travelled the world, written all the books and all the rest of it. Kubler-Ross is of the work of the devil. I've known that for years. As soon as you hear the message, you know it's of the devil. Because what does she teach? She teaches that death is a wonderful experience where you find a great white light that welcomes you in and tells you all is well, and it's a warm, lovely feeling that will make you... Who is it got most interest in telling the world that in death there is no judgment but only pleasure? That is the very message of the devil. Kubler-Ross was written up in Time magazine a few years ago now as someone who was involved in an occult religion. She was involved in a guru in California, where else. She was involved with a guru who had a view of the world which says that the spirit world would come into dark rooms with the followers of this cult, and the spirit world would actually have sex with the cult members, and the babies born would be spiritual babies, etc. And so one of the journalists from Time magazine went there and went into the room, and just at the point of having sex, pulled out their torch and had a look, and it was none other than the guru being naked. That's the kind of foolishness that a woman who has taught the world how to die well believes in. Bob Hawke. Former Dutch house planter and clairvoyant Mario Schumacher will marry Blanche and Bob next Sunday week, and has an interesting past. He's the founder of the Independent Church of Australia, formerly the Church of the Mystic Christ, in which Blanche soon hopes to become a priest. And the charismatic Schumacher has been a member of the Salvation Army, the Catholics, the Presbyterians, and the Congregational Churches. I think it's astonishing. If he'd just been an Anglican, he could have been all those at the same time. The last of which, the Congregationalist, the last of which asked him to leave after he conducted several homosexual marriages. Shoemaker and his church, a legally incorporated religious educational body, maintain a deep interest in the occult. Sun Herald, 16th of 7th, 1995. The madness, the stupidity. Rhodes Scholar, leading journalist. How do they reach such foolishness? Such idiocy. Sexual immorality and impurity in relationships. The desire of wickedness make wise people fools. And here is God's wrath. Because God gives people over to their own wickedness, and in giving them over to their own wickedness, gives them over to their own foolishness. Here is the real anger of God. He lets people have their way. If he wasn't angry with us, why, he might stop us from our foolishness. He might save us from our idiocy. But no, he is angry with the fact that we reject him. But he doesn't have to do anything more than say, okay, you want to live life without me? Go ahead. For life without me is mad. Life without me is Kafka. Life without me is Nietzsche. Life without me is lunacy. And you will find out it doesn't work, and it doesn't work. Here is God's wrath. When they no longer acknowledge God, when they no longer acknowledge God's image, they no longer treat the other person with dignity, because the other person's not in the image of God either. They now pursue sensuality for its own sake. I will do whatever I can do to make me happy, for I am God. And here is our society under God's wrath. For verses 24 to 32, where three times we have this, God gave them up, this is what we have got. And so, verse 29, they've become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, depravity. They're full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. They're gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. Here is our society at work under God's wrath. Here is your local video store. Just go in there. Just wander in and have a look. And have Romans 1 open with you. It'll lead you to very interesting conversations. But nonetheless, what you will see portrayed on the covers of the videos is exactly what is written there. And what are the videos? What are the films? What are the things that we watch? But the very images of our imagination, the very desires of our hearts, the very interests and fascinations of our deepest longings, that's what's there. Don't blame the movie makers, the TV makers, the video makers for making the garbage they make. They only make what the people want. Blame ourselves. But if you want to know what we want, that's what's there. We want adultery. We want fornication. We want titillation. We want murder. We want the excitement of crime. We want people hating. Here is the lie that we have. Bertrand Russell believed in free love until his wife started practicing it. Karl Marx was against slavery but kept one. You know, these religion has caused the wars of the world. Joe Stalin killed more than most people. He wasn't religious, he was an atheist. Adolf Hitler killed more than most people. He wasn't religious, he was an atheist. Mao Zedong killed more than most people. He wasn't religious, he was an atheist. Pol Pot, he killed a third of his population of his country. He wasn't religious, he was an atheist. This century has killed more people than any other century, and it's come from atheism, not from religion. Unless you want to call it the religion of atheism. Jung, he broke with Freud, couldn't go along with Freud. He knew Freud was a fraud. And all kinds of people are really impressed with Jung. But of course, if Jung practiced today in Australia, Jung would not only be disbarred, he'd most likely be locked up, because Jung had sex with his patients. And so created a whole string of theories that could rationalise his own wicked behaviour. And people believe them. Rousseau, the father and founder of education for children. Allow children to grow up because they are basically good. It's only the system that's evil. Just let them to be free to do their own thing. And if people were free to do their own thing because we are naturally good, we would always do the right thing. Rousseau, he had six children. Was it five? I can't remember. He couldn't either. He didn't give names to four of them, only the first one he ever gave a name to. He dropped all five of them off in the local orphanage just a month or two after their birth. All five of them were put in the orphanage, even though he knew from the reports that were there that the orphanage he placed them in led to the death of more than 50% of the children. He gave his children into death, the founder of modern educational theories on how to raise children. And people believe him and read him and quote him and prescribe him in your texts, but they don't tell you that about him, do they? They don't tell you the wickedness of the man who was so committed against all absolutes for very good reason, because of the wickedness of the man. They don't tell you. But you see, what God does, he lets people be wicked. And there is almost no greater punishment that could be given than to let people be what they want to be, wicked. So here is our understanding of the world, or rather two understandings of the world, two dominant theories that are available. As we sit and look over the world, it is ambiguous. And you could read it two different ways. I had a lovely time in New Guinea a few years back, and I was on the north coast looking over the German Sea, and it was one of those magnificent days. It was just beautiful. The sky was bluer than blue and the water bluer than blue, and the grass was just so green and the flowers were just so wild with colour that you've got to see the New Guinea flowers to perceive them. It's like our parrots, you know, it just... rich colours everywhere, and this magnificent spot I was in where the green, rich green grass went down past the flowers that were all in the garden, down to these rocks, and then out this marvellous sea that was on and on and on. It was brilliant. And there, right across the front of the property, was an 8-foot fence electrified with barbed wire all across the top of it. It was the most hideous description of the character of this fallen world that you could have. It was, the fence itself just looked violent and aggressive. Humans live there. It's an ambiguous world we're in. What do you make of it? One way of understanding it is to say that the world is a marvellous accident. The truth is something we just discover. And when we discover it, we might discover that it's not marvellous, it's just an accident. Because really, as just a big bang that's kind of extrapolated itself out into the kind of universe we're in, it's all really meaningless. That is, when you discover the truth, you discover that there is nothing to discover, that everything is just an accident, given time, given chance, given the kind of accident that it was, that there is no consciousness other than our own consciousness, that I am God and I make up the truth that I want to make up in the way I want to make up, because I am an accident too, and there is nothing in this universe. Well, here's a second understanding of the universe, that there is a truth, that this is a marvellous universe, but it is created by the Creator who made it for his purposes, and we are part of that creation. But that is a truth that we suppress because we don't like its moral implications. We don't like God being God because we want to play God. We don't like us being creatures, being manufactured items. We want to be more. And so we build the whole view of the world on a lie that there is no God, or that I am God, or that I can do as I like, or that I am the boss of me. Yet it's a lie. And like all lies, it only compounds our problems. It doesn't work out in practice, and it makes us foolish just when we think we're wise. Which view of the world is right? For For they are two very different views of the world. The first theme on truth that I want us to come to on Monday night of our mid-year conference is a negative view, really. That the truth of God we suppress because of our wickedness. We'll come back to it many times this week. We're going to pray.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.